are listening to Tech Reads, interviews with emerging technology thought leaders. Our sponsor is Softech, the premier technology trade association that has been serving northern Santa Barbara and San Luis Obispo County since 1997. Our mission is to create Softech moments where people connect, explore ideas, and create new business opportunities. Learn more at softec.org.
Peter. Hello, everyone. This is Brian Schwartz. I am the host of Tech Reads podcast for Softech. We're very grateful to our sponsors, which I recommend you check out over at Softech, softec.org. And today, our special guest is Larry Apke. And maybe he can correct my pronunciation on that last name. But
no, just Apke's fine.
Apke, okay. And we've got some a live studio audience. Ian is in the room with me, and I've got a couple of people joining us remotely. And Larry, you know, I do want to learn more about your practice and all that. But since we've got a small, intimate group today, one of the things I actually want to dive deeper into is a little bit about how you establish yourself as an expert or a thought leader in the world today, because, you know, you're writing books, you're speaking, you go in and consult with companies, but you're an independent, you know, full indie thought leader. And there's a lot of work that goes into doing that and establishing yourself in the world as an expert in a particular niche that you've picked, which is agile. So before we get into all that, and I did get a chance to listen to a chunk of your Golden Rule book, which you can talk a little bit about. Mm-hmm. But why don't you just give us the backstory a little bit and what you're up to right now?
Yeah, certainly. Right now, I've created my own consultancy, and it's really around training. It's what I've learned over the years. I call it the VUCA MBA. VUCA stands for Volatile, Uncertain, Complex, and Ambiguous. It's a term that the military used to describe the world that we live in. I think you all can empathize with that, the fact that the world is changing so much. There's so much disruption. Just look at AI, for example, or look at the pandemic and other things that have happened just recently. The world is changing very quickly. The question is, what do we do to not only just survive the disruptions, but also thrive in this world? So I've created a training that helps us with that. The MBA part stands for Mindset for Business Agility. I'm not going to give you a master's in business, but I am going to help you understand this VUCA world. The way I came to it is I was a software development director and software development manager. I ran my own small business writing software years and years ago. Wasn't that good at it, by the way, but I became pretty decent, I think, at the management of it. Somebody brought in this concept of agile, which wasn't foreign to me as far as, you know, trying to deliver value quickly. And I started becoming a scrum master and then an agile coach. And I kind of went down this rabbit hole of learning as much as I could about it and then also writing about it. It's one of the things I encourage a lot of folks to do. If you know, expertise is a tricky word, because most experts will say, well, there's still so much more to learn, but I've immersed myself for, you know, thousands and thousands of hours into the subject. So I think I have a pretty good handle on it. But every time I think I do, I find something that sends me down another rabbit hole of discovery, and it changes my mindset. So writing about it led to the first two books that we published. It was actually my son had a girlfriend who was they were in college at the time. They're still together. And she said she was doing my PR and marketing, because that's what she was doing in college. I figured I'll hire her as an intern, pay her a little bit of money. And she looked at my blog post and said, I had written 16 blog posts about the manifesto. She says, you got a book here. And I said, great, publish it. And she put it together and published it. I published another book shortly thereafter, which nobody read. I think my mom read it, but that's probably about it. And then I didn't write any more books, but I did a lot of speaking and things until this last book that I had just written, which is Apke's Golden Rule of Agile, a focus on value delivery. So I'm trying to answer your question, but I think the main thing is really just having a passion for the subject and then continuing to learn. And I always talk about it, though it's tough for me, and I think it's tough for most people. going to the world with a sense of openness and humility of saying, I don't know everything there is. There's more for me to learn. And then, you know, actively trying to learn and open your eyes to things that are different. It's a lot of what my training is. So I would be a poor instructor if I didn't eat my own dog food when it comes to that anyway.
That's great. So tell us a little bit about your coaching and what your business model currently looks like, as far as, because I read on your blog, you're kind of recently an independent, right? As of late last year.
Yeah, I was working for T-Mobile. I think you're probably familiar with them. Their commercials are everywhere. They're going through a large agile transformation. At the time, I was actually working for PG&E, which most of you are familiar with, Pacific Gas and Electric, the largest electric provider in the United States. And was looking at it like maybe this is, you know, where I was going to stay and maybe even retire. But I had worked for Apple, which is what brought me up to the Bay Area where I live now. And the gentleman who brought me up to Apple was the chief digital officer at T-Mobile. And he said, we're doing this transformation. I want you to come in and help. And so I did, because I saw it as a wonderful opportunity for me to take a lot of the things that I had learned and practiced over the years and apply them at T-Mobile. And so I did that for almost 2 years. We did some very interesting things that I'm proud of doing. One of them was we went from project and scope-based funding to product and capacity funding. We talk a little bit about that, why that's important. But it was over $1 billion that was being spent. And we transitioned all of that within about 7 months. So my understanding is historically that's the largest and fastest transformation of its kind that's existed. Now, it's not perfect. We didn't get to a lot of things I wanted to get to. But like a lot of folks in tech and IT, there were some rounds of layoffs and things of that nature. And I found myself on the other side of that. And when I exited, I thought, you know, what can I bring to the world? And what I can bring to the world is the things that I've learned over the years that are helpful for people to be successful and be optimal is the word I like to use. And so I packaged that and I called it the VUCA MBA. And that comes from a class that I've taught to thousands of people in over 50 countries through my nonprofit that I ran for years, which is called the Job Hackers, where I taught Agile and Scrum for free to people. Gave away over $6 million worth of training, et cetera, et cetera. So I've kind of honed my craft by doing that multiple times, and then I packaged it for companies to purchase, and we call it the VUCA MBA. So that's where I am today. So if anyone's interested, it's VUCAMBA.com. Basically, we have a 3-day training program that I've put together to help folks understand this VUCA world, to understand why agility is important to helping us optimize our businesses.
And that was VUCA MBA? You're saying it fast.
Yeah, it's VUCA MBA, VUCAMBA.com. Right.
Mm-hmm. And I will admit that I was not familiar with the term VUCA. I know, you know, as lots of experts are, you have analogies or you have words that you use on a daily basis, but to the outside world, it might be kind of a foreign concept. I think Bob might be more familiar with it, as you mentioned, it's a military, came out of the military complex, has been adapted by private industry. But just for those of you who aren't familiar with VUCA, that's what one of the things that Larry is very adamant and passionate about.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to talk about just as a very brief primer, in plain English, the Agile Manifesto, which is all over the internet. But I love that you've dived into explaining it. It's kind of like, so I work in publishing, and there's this thing called fan fiction, which is this huge industry of taking an idea, a concept, any characters, and building out a whole series about it. The biggest fan fiction in our existence is from the Bible. There are so many spinoffs from the Bible that are technically fan fiction, Course in Miracles, all sorts of things. What you've sort of done is done fan fiction around Agile Manifesto, if you don't mind me saying, but you've taken it and explained it in plain English. And your book talks, you have two books that I am familiar with. One of them goes into details behind what's really a very brief thing that they put up on the internet that has a bunch of people supporting, but you go into dive into each kind of the framework in much greater detail. So why don't you give us just a high level, if somebody says, what the heck is this Agile Manifesto all about?
Yeah, well, the manifesto, for those who aren't familiar with Agile and the term Agile with a big A, because I think somebody mentioned that, but it was something that there, I believe, I want to get the numbers right, I think it's 17 individuals came together in Snowbird in 2001, and they were all doing different things around software development. The prevalent way of doing software development was something that they called waterfall, which was very slow, very structured, and doesn't really deliver value to the customers as quickly as possible. So they started doing different things. That's the thing that I find most miraculous about human beings. I'm like everybody else. I got this love-hate relationship with my fellow humans. We do things that just boggle your mind at times. And then we do things like this, which is empirical knowledge saying, look, this isn't working. Let's try something else. Because, you know, kind of the definition of insanity being doing the same thing over and over again, expecting different results. So they started doing different things, and there are a lot of them out there. Scrum is the one that most people are familiar with these days, but they're doing DSDM, Crystal, feature-driven development, you name it. But they were doing different things that we could put under this Agile umbrella, but they didn't have a name for it. So they decided they'd write off a ski trip to Utah in February of 2001. And hang out. And the thing that emerged from these conversations that they had, the thing that they had in common was really a philosophy. And that philosophy was encapsulated in basically what they call the four values and then 12 principles. And these things, they didn't expect, I don't think they ever expected it to have the effect on the world that it did. But I think the reason that it had such an effect on the world is because it was what I would consider a philosophy or a mindset. So that why it's not something, it's they don't tell you what to do. They just kind of tell you what they're thinking. They're telling you what's important, what the goals of this overall, you know, software development should be. And it kind of shook up the world. And it changed a lot of things for a lot of people, because we started to realize that the world we live in is VUCA. And the things that we need to do to attack VUCA, now they didn't use these words, but I'm going to paraphrase, are different than the things that we would do in a world that is much simpler or merely complicated. But we live in this world that's very complex. And so how do we attack complexity? They nailed a lot of the things. It's not perfect, but again, you know, here we are still talking about it, you know, 23 years later. And you have a whole bunch of folks called Scrum Masters and Agile Coaches and a whole industry that's you know, kind of built around the manifesto. So, you know, early on when I was doing some blogging, I thought it was important to talk about why these things that they talked about were important and what they meant to me. And that's what ended up being the first book that I published.
And what are the four core tenets of the manifesto?
Well, the four values that I have to look up, because I don't know if I commit into memory as well as I used to in the past, but it's, you know.
Even if you just paraphrase what they're about.
Yeah, we want working product over, you know, documentation. We want to have a way of doing something other than following a plan. It's not the plan that's important. It's the work that we do. We need to work together with our clients and not just follow the instructions. If I knew you were going to ask me what the four were, I probably
would. Oh, it's okay. I don't expect, that's not fair to you that you weren't prepared. I mean, I didn't prepare you, and I prefer this to be much more authentic.
I wrote a book about them. I should probably have it in memory, but I'm getting a little older these days. So anything I can look up on Google, I don't waste the brain cells on these days. So,
well, what struck me after listening to your book, which, by the way, if anyone has an Audible membership, what's cool with Larry's work is that love him or hate him, Amazon has taken his Kindle books and made an AI narration of his books widely available through Audible for free if you're an Audible member. So I'm kind of loving that, because I actually prefer audiobooks. I just don't have time to read like I used to. And my brain is usually pretty fried by the end of the day. So last night I was listening to it, and you know, what struck me about the approach was that the needs of the user. So I kind of used to get upset that we were like the beta users of all these websites and all their software, right? Like Amazon, I feel like I'm their beta user perpetually because they keep changing things and things keep breaking. Like, when is this ever going to be out of beta? And the answer is never, because the requirements of the users are continually changing. So the reason why Agile is so important and why software developers are not like build the software and then they're done is because the user requirements are never ending and continue to evolve at just a rapid pace. And I think that what struck me with your book is how important it is to keep that mindset that you have to continually be looking at what are the customer requirements, and they may change. I go through this myself. There's something called scope creep, as you know, as a consultant, that can kill you because your billable hours are at risk, because now you're spending way up more time researching something that was never on the table when the game started and whenever the proposal started. But now you're required to, you know, figure this out. And that's just like, okay, if we reset our expectations and say, wait a minute, I know the customer requirements are going to change. And I just need to build a framework that can adapt to those continual changes, because they will continue to evolve.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's a big part of it. That's part of what I'm talking about in my book is how do you allow for that change in order to create and deliver the most value in the shortest possible time. So when I talk about, you know, AppKey's golden rule of Agile is basically I'm saying we deliver the optimal value to our customers in the shortest possible time. I was ready for that one. And the key is that because things are changing, when we identify new things, we should be able to take those new things and ask ourselves the question, is it more important to do these things than to do the things that we thought we were going to do, which goes back to the change from project and scope to capacity to capacity in product
and budget, yeah, resources.
Right.
Yeah.
So that way you have the ability to be flexible. The problem with project is I get a whole bunch of things that I want. I go get them funded, and then I have to do those things. And if I identify something else, then I have to go through change review process and all these processes because it's out of scope. You know, if you're doing a truly agile way of doing business, as I outline in the book, you don't have to say that, because what you're doing is you're making an investment up front, saying I'm going to invest X number of dollars this quarter, this year, whatever. And I'm going to do the most valuable things I can with that money. And I'm going to identify things, obviously, along the way. And I should be doing those things that are valuable along the way, as opposed to saying, here's the scope that you paid for. You're going to get it regardless of what happens, right?
Doesn't that create a training and quality problem up and down the chain?
No, it doesn't. It's just you have to build a system that accepts change and can react to change on a regular basis. And that's different, which is why a lot of what I talk about, and when I talk about the success and what I talk about my training, is it really has to do with mental models and lenses, the way we view the world. Because the way we view the world is going to determine how we think about the world, and how we think about the world will determine how we behave in the world. So if we're used to thinking in one way, then it becomes a little bit more difficult if you're trying to change the system. If I only change software development to be faster, but I don't change the rest of the organization to accept the speed of change, and I think your example was documentation and training, then I am going to have problems, because there's going to be a mismatch between folks who are agile and folks who aren't, which is one of the big problems actually in the world of Agile with the big A that Rich was talking about, is that they just bring on frameworks and they work with teams, but unless they take a systemic approach, you can optimize a piece of the system without optimizing the overall system. I can deliver more value from a software delivery standpoint without delivering more value for the company, because the whole entire company needs to be able to accept the changes quickly. So if I'm doing training, which is where I came from actually to start out in this business, I came from training and development. You have to be able to understand the changes that are being made in the software instead of following a plan, you know, kind of in parallel.
you have to get the feedback from the software developers. You have to be working closely with software developers to understand what's coming up so that you can prepare that. Same with documentation, same with other things. Of course, with documentation, there's techniques like behavior-driven development that keep documentation actually in front of development. So again, it's just different ways of looking at the world, because if I can work with an entire organization to show the different ways we can look at the world and change our behavior to match this agility, then we can have a much better product from beginning to end.
Right, but as an old software developer, the thing that scares me when I listen to these frameworks is that there are always unintended consequences to the little change. My biggest disasters have started with the sentence, "It's just a simple change." And you know, it cascades through the system. It does all sorts of weird things, all because they didn't take the time to thoroughly analyze what the hell they were doing.
So, yes.
The faster you go, the more dangerous it becomes.
Well, yes, it does, but I'm going to give you a counter argument, which is that the safest place for the ship is in the port, but that's not what ships are built for. So right. The question becomes, how do we become safe and fast with software development? That means that we have to change our perspective, our viewpoint, our mindset, the way we look at the world, because there are ways that we can do speed and quality at the same time in software development, fortunately, and we've known these for some time. These are things like pair programming, mob programming, test-driven development, behavior-driven development, automated testing, DevOps, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. There are many things we can do. Now, if you're just going to go fast and shove things down a system that's not ready for it, of course you're going to have problems, right? That's like creating a car that can go 300 miles an hour and sending it down a one-lane, you know, wooden bridge or something like that. You just certainly wouldn't do that. But there are things you can do. And that's where people get into trouble. Agile is about the speed with which we can change successfully, not just the speed that we can move, right? And that's a big problem. This is one of the things that kind of bothers me, and maybe I go too much off on this, but it bothers me about others, and maybe I was guilty of it in the past. We have to look at things systemically. We cannot just say, hey, I'm an agile coach. We're going to do things faster. We don't do things faster. We do things better so we can do things faster. We slow down so that we can speed up. Those kind of things are counterintuitive, which is why you need a good guide through this world. Because if not, obviously you can make mistakes, and those mistakes can be quite catastrophic, as you said.
Yeah, and I think those are all good points. Before I shift over to the business, because this was, like I said, my personal pivot on this conversation today, because you can certainly catch Larry's podcast. He's very prolific in the podcasting world. You can listen to all of the Larry you could possibly want, but I want to dive more into the expert business side. Rich or Rick, do you guys have any questions for specific and Ian as well to Agile as really from a software development perspective? Because I don't want to, you know, throw that off until you guys feel your questions have been met.
I come from a design build architecture construction background. And so certainly some of this, you know, design build versus going to an architect and a contractor separately is somewhat, you know, an agile model in that you're building it into the system to be able to make changes more quickly versus going to back to a, you know, you go to the architect and they draw up plans, and then you go to a contractor and they say, okay, this is two times your budget. And then you go back to the architect, you know, whereas if you're in a design build, you tend to be a little bit more
fluid.
Yeah. Yeah. But at the end of the day, you still have to build a house. And in this case, it's fixed. It does not change very much. Yeah. It's much more difficult to change that than it is software. Mm-hmm. But,
agreed. In fact, I would go so far as to say that when we look at the world of design and architecture, we consider that complex. There's so many different choices and things you can do. It's a blank slate. It's like writing software. Once you have a design, the actual construction, if you're familiar with Kinevin, talks about the four quadrants, it's in a different quadrant. It's in the complicated quadrant. We've been building structures for a very long time. We can use checklists, right? Because that's what, I mean, tell me if I'm wrong here. That's what building inspectors do. They have a checklist. They have best practices. This is a different world. So the thing that we have to understand, one of the things I teach and what we have to understand is we have to understand which world we're in. Construction work, the actual work of construction is less VUCA than design, right? Software development is certainly much more VUCA than, you know, digging ditches. It really depends where you are on kind of that spectrum of simple, complicated, complex. But once you get into, off into the complex world, the things that we need to do to be successful are radically different in some respects than what we would do to be successful in the simple and the complicated world. The way, the analogy I'd love to use is checkers is simple. Chess is complicated. Poker is complex. And if you know the difference between those, right? The reason chess is merely complicated is you can teach a computer algorithms and they can do it and they beat humans every day. You can learn all the moves on the board. The board only has a certain number of squares, et cetera, et cetera. You go to play poker, you got to worry about your opponents. It's not just the cards in your hand, right? There's so much more that goes into being successful in complexity that doesn't go into either the simple or the complicated.
Right. And I like that you talked about wicked problems where, you know, if you solve, it's often been said, if you can solve the greatest problems, have the biggest payoff, right? Pick a big problem to solve. And, you know, you've got a unicorn or this moonshot, whatever you want to call it. And wicked problems are the kind that are difficult to really grasp because they're unpredictable, like poker, right? Your opponent is a moving target. And just when you think it's like even rock, paper, scissors, if you saw that Squid Games reality show, at the very last game was rock, paper, scissors. But it turned out to be the mind game that this woman won on because the kid kept thinking he was going to predict what she was going to do next. And she would do exactly the opposite of what every single time. And she won.
There's a lot of this in like game theory, if you think of Beautiful Mind as well. I mean, you are living in a different world when you're in the complex world. The problem that, as I foresee it, and I was just talking, we were talking about books. I'm reading Sapiens right now, which is wonderful because what it's telling, reinforcing a lot of stuff that I already knew. We evolved for a very long time in a world that was rather simple. And so our brains are good at simple. And we try to make the complex simple. And we try to apply the rules of simplicity to the complex world. The problem is you can, but you're not going to be optimal. And that's really what I'm looking for. I don't want to talk about right or wrong, good or bad, because they don't exist in the VUCA world. What I want to talk about is I want to talk about, am I optimal doing what I can do in this world? And there's no one answer to it. We're always looking for the answer or an answer, and it just doesn't exist in this world. So it's very, very counterintuitive, which is why it makes it so difficult to do and to do well. And again, this is why I make the proposition that you need somebody, whether it's me or somebody else, to help guide you to understand it. I'm not going to tell you rules or things that are going to help you to tame it per se. I'm going to help you understand it so that when you see these things, you'll recognize them and then you'll have a better chance of being successful. But there's no guarantee, just like poker, there's no guarantee of success. You can have a great hand and lose. You can have a terrible hand and win. That's how life is. That's the VUCA world.
Bob?
And which of those categories do you put software into?
Well, I put software development.
Poker, chess?
I put software development in more into the chess because the analogy is it's complex. It's not merely complicated most of the time.
But the way humans interact with it is more of a VUCA world, right? You don't really know what people are thinking. Maybe it's almost like a prescription drug. Like they build an app to do one thing and they find out that people are using it for something totally different. They're like, well, damn, pivot and start going after that niche because you've just found like a prescription drug that all of a sudden now it's solving a different problem than you set out to solve.
Which happens. I believe the story of Slack, if I had it right, was because it was a way for people who were gaming to converse with each other, and they figured out the conversations and the instant messaging piece or whatever you want to call it was more valuable. They pivoted to that and the rest is history.
Yeah. Well, and before we get off we'll just wrap up this topic, but Larry, you should also read about Untethered Soul and Michael Singer and the studies he's done between the left and the right. He refers to these studies where you know, people who basically they've severed the connection between. And as human beings, we basically make stories for our brains to comprehend what has happened. And as I'm, my parents are aging and 82, like it's so like crystal clear that they are drawing conclusions because the brain power that's available to them is not what it used to be. And they are shortening a conclusion to explain what's happening at a much faster, like much quicker. And I can say, well, where did they draw that conclusion? Like, how are you even coming up with this? But in their mind, that's reality. Yep. And it's crazy, but they, you can tell because they're struggling to remember something they said 30 minutes previously. But it's just funny the way our brains fill in the gaps to explain what's happening when there's no rhyme or reason to what's actually, that explanation is completely off.
100%. In my class, I would describe it as one of the more interesting agile classes because there's two comments, and I have tons of comments and people who comment on what I've done. I mean, hundreds and hundreds because of the main number of people I've taught. There are two things that were very interesting about this that people would come back to me and they say, Larry, this is the least practical training I've ever received in my life. And I say, why? And they say, well, because you didn't teach us how to use Jira. You didn't give us a cookbook. I wanted a cookbook. I always say I don't want to create cooks. I want to create chefs. But they didn't think it was practical because I didn't give them a cookbook. And that's what they were looking for in the training. And then I'd have other people come to me and say, it's the most practical training I ever received. I said, why? They said, well, because you taught us underlying principles of things that I need to look out for and recognize and how to respond. And therefore, I can respond to many different things. And they're both right. Because, and I teach about saying it's unusual. I teach about cognitive biases. I teach about sociology and psychology. I teach about how complexity is different. I teach about how knowledge workers are fundamentally different than physical laborers. All this stuff is a bit counterintuitive. But it's different because once we realize that reality, I believe, anyway, this is my belief, reality exists. I refer to it in my training as objective reality, that which sits outside of me as an individual. But none of us can see and access objective reality as it is. We cannot. It's impossible. Physiologically, it's impossible, as Brian was pointing out. We filter it. So our view of reality is always different than somebody else's view of reality. And one of the major problems that we have as human species is that we all assume that we see the same reality. Now I think politically we've seen that, you know, played out in this country differently over the last maybe 5 to 10 years, how people can see the world so completely differently that it becomes almost impossible for us to communicate. And this is a problem in business, because if you're in the VUCA world, the key to succeeding in the VUCA world or the complex world is feedback. And the feedback needs to be fast, accurate, and actionable. But the problem is if you have two people talking and they can't understand each other, how can you get fast, accurate, actionable feedback? So we have to start understanding and comprehending that the hardest thing we can do as human beings is to understand another person's reality. But we have to try to make that attempt. So when I'm teaching and training and consulting with people, it's very rare that I'll tell people what to do. I'll tell people, this is what I see. And what do you see? And let's start with that. Because if we're not seeing the same things, we're going to be talking about two different things, though we think we're talking about the same thing. And this is really a so primary to what we do in the world of relationships. And business, because the world of business is a world of relationships. And so it's fraught with all kinds of problems that we're blind to. And we have to remove that blind spot. It doesn't mean we're going to get that much better. It doesn't mean that by removing the blind spot, we're not going to every once in a while, you know, go veer off into the lane and hit somebody. It just means that we're going to have a better chance or a better odds of not having some of the problems that we currently have. And frequently have, or almost, you know, chronically have.
Ian, did you have a comment?
Oh, I was just saying it's very similar. A lot of the things you're saying very similar to the fast and slow thinking of Daniel Kahneman.
Perfect. Yes, I come
doing, you know, from, you know, thinking one, thinking brain one versus thinking brain two, and much of what you're talking, it's a lot of that, of those concepts.
Well, and those of you who have kids, I think probably see this a lot more. I just don't have kids. I'm seeing it with my parents for the first time. Like, what? And I imagine kids make these, draw these same conclusions because they're off of, going off of a very small knowledge base, right, of information that they've experienced. So they see the world differently than we do. And sometimes they see it more objectively than we do. I think that, you know, the longer we live, the more difficult it gets to be objective about the world, because we're dealing with all this data that we've been collecting for 50, 60, 70 years. A lot of it's no longer relevant, but we don't, it's a struggle. Anyway, go ahead.
I just briefly to just talk about that concept, because in my training, I often tell people it's not the people who know, I'll put this in quote, know Agile that are easiest for me to train. It's much easier for me to train somebody who has zero knowledge of Agile, because I think even Twain said it, it's not what man knows that gets him in trouble. It's what he thinks he knows that is true, that is not, that gets him in trouble. And this is what I found in my practice, because I've trained people who may have heard of Agile yesterday and heard there's a class and that it would help them. So they show up and they have no conception whatsoever. And then I have coaches who've been coaches for a dozen years and they take my class. Now, everybody can get something from it, but it really depends on what you bring to it. Because if you're open to what I have to say, then you're going to get value from it. If you're closed, there's no sense taking my training anyway. It's not going to help, right? I'm not going to show you how to use Jira better. It's just not my training. If that's, and that's a lot of what people who are closed-minded. And this is a problem, because this is the way we're built. We're built for a confirmation bias. We're built to see the world as we see it, and we're going to look for the evidence that we're right. We love to feel right. I just got done talking about that last week. We love to feel right. We don't really want to be right. And there's a difference between the two. And we have to get into a place where if you want to be most successful in your life, you want to be most successful in your business, you have to want to be right, not feel right, right? That's easy enough. Turn on the TV, pick your poison on which news you want to cover, right, left, whatever, and it's going to tell you exactly what you want to hear. You're going to feel right, but you're not going to be right necessarily.
Well, and it's okay not to know the answer. I think the big thing that I'm getting from the Michael Singer's work is like our brains want to solve and know the answer, and we feel very uncertain. Like it's very uncomfortable when we don't know the answer, so we tend to fill it in, and oftentimes it's not accurate, but then we can sort of move on in life. Right. But anyway, way more philosophical than I intended to get. Let's just wrap up. You know, we got about 10 minutes left. Let's just chat a little bit about the business of being an expert in 2024 going forward. You are in the thick of it. I love it because you're in the trenches as somebody who is a thought leader, establishing himself as a thought leader. There's a lot of noise in the market. And you've got a website, you've got ebooks, you've got now audiobooks, you've got all these different things pointing back to you. But tell me a little bit about the business of being an expert who consults with corporations, and what your sort of typical strategy is to grow your presence. You know, you're very prolific on podcasts. You make yourself available, but you also got to carve out time to run your business. Mm-hmm. So tell us a little bit about just building this, and what is your brand? Is it your name? Is it Agile? Is it VUCA? Like, if you had to brand yourself, what would that look like?
Well, I think the brand is me. And I think that this is what I recommend to anybody who is trying to do what I'm trying to do. And it's great that I've had the wonderful opportunities to be on the podcasts, write the books, the blog posts, the training, YouTube, all these places that I am, because to a certain degree, I'm rather ubiquitous on these things. If you're looking for me, the kind of things I do. But it's a tough world out there. So I started on my own at the end of last year, and I'm still trying to find my niche. So I don't want to say I figured it out yet. But I think what it amounts to for me is, what I really want to do is I want to help people, because what I've found is I've gone down those rabbit holes. I've learned a lot of things, and those, some of those things are valuable for people, and it's worthwhile that they pay me some money for it. And I think it's hugely valuable for certain places. in certain companies, especially larger companies who are looking to do some of these transitions. So that's what I bring to the world, but I bring it to the world because I want to help people. Because there's, look, you talk about, you know, the mind and how the mind works. Well, there's this, there's these things in your brain called dopamine receptors. And dopamine's that thing that we get that makes us feel good about what we're doing. And to a certain extent, we have serotonin and oxytocin and other ones. But I get, it's like a drug for me to do the work that I do. Because there's nothing that's more addictive than getting paid to help other people. And that's really what it's about for me, is I love nothing more than when I can present something to somebody, like in this group or in the classes that I teach, and I can see the light bulbs going off in somebody's head. I can see that I've touched them in certain ways, that because once you see the world differently, you can't unsee it. That's the beauty of the human mind. So I always talk about them as aha moments. And anytime I can get an aha moment from the crowd, just like people who sing or other things, people go on stage or whatever it may be, you just get that shot of dopamine. And it just, that's what keeps driving me to do what I do. And I don't care necessarily what form it takes, right? Whether it's an independent consultant, whether, you know, somebody like T-Mobile, large business, hires me tomorrow and pays me a bunch of money to help them, as long as I get the ability to help other people. That's what really drives me.
Well, and I just noticed you're out there in these different formats, kind of trying to rise above the noise, right? You got LinkedIn, you've got podcasts, you've got speaking engagements, you've got conferences, which are coming back. Like, as someone who's establishing themselves or has established themselves as a thought leader, but does not want to be the world's greatest undiscovered legend, because there's no shortage of brilliant minds out there who nobody knows about. And aren't really either heard or appreciated for what they can bring to the table, but at the same time, aren't making an effort to do that. I just think I admire the fact that you're putting yourself out there right now, maybe in a transitional time, or you don't plan to go back to corporate America. Is this sort of your plan, is to stay free and independent till the end?
My job is to help as many people as I can before I decide to hang up my shoes and retire.
So you're open to whatever form that takes.
Yeah, I mean, my strength is in teaching others, I believe, because I've done it. I've got a track record with it. There's a bunch of people, if you ask them, was this helpful to me? I think they'd say, yes, it was helpful. That's where I want to be in my life. And so whatever form that takes. When I was with T-Mobile, you're talking about a very large organization. I got to train, you know, hundreds, if not thousands of people in talking about some of the things, same things we're talking about today. So to me, that's what drives me. And if I in any way I can do that, then I win. If I get paid for it, I win more.
Okay.
Right. But it's not, you know, money's not what drives me. Now, talk to me in 6-7 months if I don't get any more business or I don't have a job. Different story, right? Because we all have to eat. But until that time, I'm just going to try to do my best to help other people. And then I'm going to believe that there's going to be people who find me who need what I do and are willing to pay for it.
I think that's the right perspective to have. You're not tied to a particular end game, which can be dangerous because you're the world will never show up the way you want. You're being agile. So you're trying to live your philosophy. Yeah. As you build that expertise, build that business. Before we wrap up, anyone on the Zoom or Ian, you guys have any other questions for, Larry? What's that, Bob?
No, it's Rich. I didn't have any questions, but yeah, you beat me to the agile joke for Larry. Being agile to reach his goals.
It's a good philosophy to take in life. I think being, you know, I was going to try to come up with ways for you to help fix my overwhelm problem, Larry, of too many tasks and never enough time. And can Agile fix that for me? And that would be a whole nother podcast. But it's sort of like what I was telling you with the guys from Agile Conversations, where they're taking some of the framework of Agile and looking to apply it in organizations to improve your life. And just, okay, well, I'm not a software developer, but I know that there's some real value in learning the framework and how I can apply that to my own life.
So just briefly on that one, I'm going to give another plug to the book because the book talks about that. When I do my trainings, I have this spreadsheet of honeydew items. You all know
that's
honeydew.
That's right. You can't see the honeydew book list in the audiobook. Go ahead.
Right. You can't see it in the audiobook, but you know, a honeydew list is all the stuff that your honey says, honeydew this, honeydew that. I have a real list from Arizona back when I lived there. I put it in a spreadsheet. And what we do is we go through an exercise that I outline in the book to identify the relative value and effort of the work that we can do. Because in the end, here's another quirk of the human mind. We think we can multitask. We can't. We want to focus. That's a whole big part of being successful in this VUCA world, is figuring out what to focus on and then actually focusing on it and getting it done, not just partially completed, right? So that's what it's about. So your to-do list, and you say, I've got too many things, you run them through this process. You're going to start to see those things that I can do that are going to give me the most value for the shortest amount of time. It's very easy to do. It doesn't take a lot of time. And it allows the flexibility when new tasks come in to reevaluate the tasks and resequence them. I talk about sequence because you can do one thing, then you do another thing, then you do another thing, do another thing. This is a very important word because I want to focus. I want to put a sequence, and I want that sequence to be the sequence that delivers the most value in the shortest amount of time.
Yeah, you talked about the value and effort ratio. I remember that.
Yep.
And you're right, because there will always be more demands on you than time allows. And it is always comes down to you have to make that hard decision of what you are going to commit yourself to. But I think if your methodology can also help people get into that state of flow, which is when I'm working on something and I'm not worried about the time of what's coming next, that's my happy place. But it's so rare because I always have something coming up that I have to basically, I'm sort of nagging at me that I know I'm going to run out of time. But those days where you can just sit down unencumbered by what's coming up are those days that you get into that deep work.
At a high level, can you compare the Agile to Lean?
Well, Agile for me is a broad tent that encompasses the thinking of Lean. It encompasses the frameworks, the various frameworks, everything else. So I would say Lean is a subset of Agile. There's probably those who would disagree with me. But to me, it is, again, a way of thinking, and it's borrowed actually from manufacturing. We do borrow a lot of ideas from manufacturing, even though it's in the complicated world of how we can move things through the system and reduce waste. Which is what Lean is to me. So to me, applying the principles of Lean, understanding Lean, just allows us to exhibit agility.
Just to me, when I look at Lean, and Eric Olson runs a local group here for Lean, and the difference that I see is that he proposes it more as a continual improvement process, which is what Agile sounds like to me.
Agile, to achieve agility, you have to go through continual improvement.
Which is the basis of Lean. That's why I have trouble separating the two. And maybe they don't separate.
I don't think they do. Again, I think Lean, I would consider Lean as part of a subset of what are the ideas that I have? What are the things I can do to achieve agility? I like the word agility better than agile. Agile is, unfortunately, and Brian was alluding to it, there's so many people out there who in my business call themselves agile coaches. Some, like any other profession, some are good and some are bad, but there's certifications, but there's no real way of knowing sometimes. And there's a lot of voices out there. So, you know, who do you listen to, et cetera, et cetera. My perspective is that agility is a better word because that's what we hope to achieve. Agility being the ability to change quickly and successfully over time. And it's not just once, right? It's all the time. It's continual. So there's a lot of lean, what I would consider lean thinking in my approach. But I would consider that lean thinking a subset of a whole bunch of other thinking that I would bundle under Agile.
Yeah, agility is the key to resilience, right? And we need more of that than ever.
Right. And I'd like to go beyond resilience and to thrive, right? Resilience is I'm able to withstand the things that come after me. And thriving is, you know, it's anti-fragile. If you're familiar with the book, this concept of anti-fragility, there are companies that are fragile, that when change comes, they're going to die. This is, I'm trying to remember the gentleman's name who wrote the book. It eludes me for the second, but there are companies that are resilient, that when change comes, they're able to survive. And then there's companies that's Nassim Taleb is his name. Anti-fragile is the name of the book. And there are companies that are anti-fragile that thrive in this kind of VUCA world. One of them that we're all familiar with, and I think is a pretty decent example, is one that you alluded to before, which is Amazon. They tend to thrive in the VUCA world when they were very well poised for the pandemic. And they seem to do it pretty well. There are others, but that's the first one that always comes to mind with me, because they seem to thrive in no matter what. And they certainly thrived very well in the pandemic. They were well positioned to thrive.
They've got some challenges ahead of them, but at the same time, they've also proven that they can overcome quite a few, you know, and maybe they're not as well positioned right now as they were during the pandemic. So there were certainly factors at play that helped them thrive, but there's no doubt they are one of the companies that have figured it out. Well, Larry, I really appreciate you taking time for us at TechReads. We could go on for on and on, but in the interest of your time and everyone who's listening, why don't you just share a little bit about how they can get a hold of you if people want to learn more?
Yeah, absolutely. The wonderful thing is it's easy to get a hold of me because there's only one Larry Apke out there. That's APKE. So if you look for Larry Apke on Google, you look for Larry Apke on LinkedIn, you're going to find me pretty easily. So that's probably the easiest way to do it. As I mentioned before, there is the VUCA MBA, which is my offering, the 3-day training, VUCAMBA.com. There's also LarryApke.com. So as long as you spell my name right, you can find my blog that I had for years. And I encourage folks to just reach out either on LinkedIn or anywhere. And if you have questions, again, I'm passionate about it. Reach out to me. We'll get some time on my calendar. We'll sit down. We'll do a Zoom conference. We'll talk together. Because I want to be out there to help people. And as I said before, I think if I help people first, the money will come. And so I'm not as concerned about making the money. I'm more concerned with helping others.
That's the right mindset, in my opinion. So, all right, I'm going to stop recording. Everyone, thank you again for being part of TechReads. We'll stay on for just a second.
Thank you for listening to Tech Reads, sponsored by Softech. If you enjoyed today's show, please subscribe and share it with your colleagues. If you have comments, questions, or want to suggest an author for a future episode, visit Softech at softec.org and click on the Tech Reads link.